Side 13, Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 389. I almost weep as I realize that she's the only human being on Earth, except for Nightenhalzer, who may be dead by now, who knows my name. Are you hurt, Hockenberry? Hurt? I manage, no, I'm not hurt. Helen leads me into the bathing room adjoining her bedchamber. This is where I first saw her that night. Candles are lighted here as well. There is water in a basin, and I see my reflection. Red-eyed, stubble-cheeked, exhausted. I realize that I haven't really slept for how long. I can't remember. Sit, says Helen, and I collapse onto the ledge of a marble bathtub. Why have you come, Hockenberry? Stumbling with words, I say, I tried to find the fulcrum, and go on to explain my useless charade with Achilles, the kidnap of Patroclus, my plan to turn the heroes of the war against the gods to save everyone, everything. But you did not kill Patroclus, says Helen, her dark eyes intense. No, I just took him elsewhere. Using the gods' method of travel, says Helen, yes. But you could not spirit away Astyanax, Hector's son. This way. I shake my head dumbly. I see Helen thinking, her beautiful dark eyes lost in reverie. How can she believe my explanations? Who in the hell does she think I am? Why had she befriended me before? Befriended being somewhat of a euphemism for that long night of passion. And what will she do with me now? As if to answer that last question, Helen rises with a grim look in her eye and goes out of the bathing room. I hear her calling names in the hallway, and know that the guards will be back with her in less than a minute. So I raise my hand to the heavy QT medallion. I can't think of anywhere to go. I have charge left in my taser baton, but I don't reach for it as Helen returns with several others, but not guards. Serving girls, slaves. A minute later they are undressing me, stacking my filthy garments by the wall, as other young women bring in tall pitchers of steaming hot water for the bath. I let them take the morphing bracelet off me, but I cling to the QT medallion. I shouldn't get it wet, but I don't want it out of my reach. You are going to bathe, Hockenberry, says Helen of Troy. She lifts a short, gleaming razor blade. And then I am going to shave you myself. Here, drink this. It will restore your energy and spirits. She hands me a goblet with a thick liquid inside. What is it? I ask. Nestor's favorite drink, laughs Helen. Or it was when the old fool used to visit my husband Menelaus. It restores. I sniff it, knowing that I'm being boorish. What's in it? Wine, grated cheese, and barley, says Helen, lifting the goblet closer to my lips by moving my cupped hands upward. Her fingers look very white against my sun-darkened and dirty skin. But I also add honey to sweeten it. So does Circe, I say, laughing stupidly. Who? Hockenberry? I shake my head. Never mind, it's in the Odyssey, doesn't matter. Irrelevant and immaterial. I drink. The liquid has the punch of a Missouri mule. I wonder idly if there are any mules in Missouri circa 1200 BC. The young servant girls have stripped me naked, having me stand to pull off my tunic and underthings. I don't even think to be embarrassed. I'm too tired, and the drink has given my brain a distinct buzz. Bathe, Hockenberry, says Helen, and offers me her arm to hold as I step into the deep and steaming bath. I will shave you in the bath. The water is so hot that I cringe like a child, lowering myself carefully, hesitating to let the steaming water touch my scrotum. But I do. I'm too tired to fight gravity. And when I lean back against the slanted marble back of the tub, Helen's servants lathering my whiskers, stubbled cheeks and neck, I don't even worry about Helen handling the razor's blade so close to my eyes and jugular. I trust her. Feeling Nestor's drink giving me energy again, deciding that if Helen offers me her bed, I'll definitely ask her to share it with me in this last hour or so before dawn. I close my eyes for just a moment, just a few seconds. When I awake, it's mid-morning, at least, with heavy light coming through small windows high on the wall. I'm shaved and clean, even perfumed. I'm also lying on a cold stone floor in an empty room, not in Helen's high bed. And I'm naked, completely naked, not even the QT medallion in sight. As real awareness flows into my brain like reluctant water into a leaky basin, I notice that I'm tied with multiple leather straps to iron rings in the wall and floor. Leather restraints run from my wrists, knotted together over my head to the wall. Straps from my bound ankles, legs spread apart, run a few inches to two other iron rings in the floor. This posture and situation would be embarrassing and alarming even if I were alone, but I'm not. Five women are standing over me, staring down at me. None of them look amused. I tug at the leather reins as I instinctively try to cover my genitals, but the straps are short and my hands don't even lower to the level of my shoulders. Nor do the straps on my ankles allow me to close my legs. I see now that all of the women are carrying daggers, although some of the blades seem long enough to be called swords. I know the women. Besides Helen in the center, there is Hecuba, King Priam's queen, Hector's and Paris's gray-haired but attractive mother. Next to Hecuba is Laodice, the queen's daughter and the warrior Helicaon's wife. To the left of Helen is Theano, Cisseus' daughter, the Trojan horseman Antenor's wife. But, and possibly more relevant to my current situation, Ilium's primary priestess serving the goddess Athena. I can't imagine that Theano will be happy to hear that this mere mortal man has taken the form and used the voice of the goddess she's served her entire life. I look at Theano's grim expression and guess that she's already heard the news. Finally, there is Andromache, Hector's wife, the woman whose child I was going to kidnap and carry away to exile in Indiana. Her expression is the sternest of all the women's. She is tapping a long, razor-sharp dagger against her palm, and she looks impatient. Helen sits on a low couch near me. Hockenberry, you need to tell us all the story you have told me. Who you are, why you have been watching the war, what the gods are like, and what you tried to do during the night. Will you release me first? My tongue feels thick. She drugged me. No, speak now. Tell only the truth. Theano has been given the gift from Athena of telling truth from lies, even from someone whose accent is as barbaric as yours. Speak now, leave nothing out. I hesitate. Perhaps my best bet here might be to keep my mouth shut. Theano goes to one knee next to me. She's a lovely young woman with pale gray eyes like her goddess. Her dagger blade is short, broad, double-edged, and very cold. I know the cold part because she's just laid the blade under my testicles, lifting them like an offering on a silver serving knife. The dagger's point draws blood in my sensitive perineum, and my whole body tries to contract and rise away even as I just succeed in not crying out. Tell everything. Lie about nothing, whispers Athena's high priestess. At your first lie, I will feed you your left stone. Your second lie, you eat the right one. Your third lie, and I will be feeding my hounds whatever is left. So, all right, I tell everything. Who I am, how the gods have revived me for scholic duty, my impressions of Olympus, my revolt against my muse, my attack on Aphrodite and Ares, my plot to turn Achilles and Hector against the gods, everything. The point of her dagger never moves, and the metal under me never warms. You took the form of the goddess Athena, whispers Theano. You have this in your power? The tools I carry do, I say, or they did. I actually close my eyes and grit my teeth, waiting for the cut, slash, plop. Helen speaks. Tell Hecuba, Laodice, Theano, and Andromache about your view of the near future, our fates. He is no seer, granted such vision by the gods, says Hecuba. He is not even civilized. Listen to his speech, bar, 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 bar. He admits to coming from far away, says Helen. He can't help being a barbarian, but listen to what he sees in our future, noble daughter of Dymas. Tell us, Hockenberry. I lick my lips. Theano's eyes are the transparent North Sea gray of a true believer, of Waffen SS man's eyes. Hecuba's eyes are dark and don't show as much intelligence as Helen's. Laodice's gaze is hooded, Andromache's bright and fierce and dangerously strong. What do you want to know, I say? Anything I say will be about the fate of these people's lives and husbands and city and children. Everything that is true, everything that you think you know, says Helen. I hesitate only a second, then, trying to pay no attention to Theano's feminist blade against my nether regions. This is not a vision of the future, I say, but rather my memory of a tale that is told of your future, which is my past. Knowing that what I just said can't make any sense to any of them, and wondering if it even came through my barbarous accent. Accent? I don't think I speak this Greek with an accent. I tell them about the days and months to come. I tell them that Ilium will fall, that blood will run in the streets, and that all their homes will be put to the torch. I tell Hecuba that her husband Priam will be murdered at the foot of Zeus's statue in their private temple. I tell Andromache that her husband Hector will be cut down by Achilles when no one from the city has the nerve to go out and fight alongside her love, and that Hector's body will be dragged around the city behind Achilles' chariot, and then be dragged back to the Achaean camp to be pissed on by the soldiers and worried by the Greek dogs. Then I tell her that in just a few weeks her son Scamandrius will be thrown down from the highest point on the city's wall, his brains dashed out on the rocks below. I tell Andromache that her pain will not be over then, because she will be condemned to live and to be dragged back to the Greek Isles as a slave, how she will end her days serving meals to the men who killed Hector and burned her city and killed her son. But she will end her days listening to their jokes and sitting silently while the aging Achaean heroes tell stories about these glorious days of rape and plunder. I describe to Laodice and Theana the rape of Cassandra and the rape of thousands of the Trojan women and girls, and how thousands more will choose the sword rather than such shame. I tell Theano of how Odysseus and Diomedes will steal the sacred Palladion stone from Athena's secret temple, and then return in conquest to desecrate and destroy the temple itself. I tell the priestess with the blade at my balls how Athena does nothing, nothing, to stop this rape and plunder and desecration. And I repeat to Helen the details of Paris's death and her own enslavement at the hands of her former husband Menelaus. And then, when I've told everything I know from the Iliad and explain again how I don't know that all of this will come to pass, but explain how so much from the poem has come to pass during my 9 years of duty here, I stop. I could tell them about Odysseus' wanderings, or about Agamemnon's murder after his homecoming, or even about Virgil's Aeneid, with the ultimate triumph of Troy in the founding of Rome. But they wouldn't care about any of that. When I finish my litany of doom, I fall silent. None of the five women are crying. None of the five shows any expression that wasn't on her face when I'd begun my descriptions of their fate. Exhausted, depleted, I close my eyes and await my own fate. They allow me to dress, although Helen has the servants bring me fresh undergarments and tunic. Helen holds up each tool, the QT medallion, the taser baton, the Hades helmet, and the morphing bracelet, and asks if it is part of my power borrowed from the gods. I consider lying. I especially want the Hades helmet back, but in the end I tell the truth about each item. Will it work for one of us if we try to use it? Asks Helen. Here I hesitate, because I really don't know. Did the gods make the baton and morphing bracelet fingerprint dependent to keep the weapon out of Greek and Trojan hands if we fell on the battlefield? Quite possibly. None of us Skoliks ever asked. The morphing device and the QT medallion, at least, will require some training, and I tell the women that. The Hades helmet will almost certainly work for anyone, since it is a stolen artifact. Helen keeps all of the tools, leaving me only the impact armor that is woven into my cape and leather breastplate. She puts the priceless gifts from the gods in a small embroidered bag. The other women nod, and we leave. We leave Helen's house, the five women and me, and walk through the mid-morning city streets to the Temple of Athena. What's going to happen, I ask, as we hurry through the crowded lanes and alleys? Five grim-faced women in black robes not dissimilar from 20th-century Muslim burqas, and one confused man. I keep looking above the rooftops, expecting the muse to appear in her chariot at any moment. Silence, hisses Helen. We will speak when Theano casts silence around us so even the gods cannot hear. Before we enter the temple, Thieno produces a black robe and insists I pull it on. Now we all look like robed women entering the temple through a back door, moving down empty corridors, although one of the six women is wearing combat sandals. I've never been in the temple, and my glimpse into the main hall through open doors is not disappointing. The space is huge, mostly dark, lighted by hanging braziers and votive candles. It smells and feels most like a Catholic church to me, the scent of incense in a cavernous space where even the echoes are hushed. But instead of a Catholic altar and statues of the Virgin Mary and Child, this space is dominated by a huge central statue to Athena, 30 feet tall at least, carved of white stone but garishly painted with red lips, blushing cheeks, pink skin. The goddess's gray eyes look to be made of mother-of-pearl stone, and she is brandishing an elaborate shield of real gold, a breastplate of burnished copper inlaid with gold, a sash of lapis lazuli, and a 40-foot spear of real bronze. It's impressive, and I pause at the open door, staring into the sanctuary. There, right there, by Athena's sacred sandaled feet, will Ajax the Great trap and rape Cassandra, Priam's daughter. Helen comes back, seizes my arm, and roughly pulls me along the corridor. I wonder if I'm the first man ever to see into the inner sanctuary of Athena's temple in Ilium. Isn't the Pleiadian statue and the temple itself watched over by young virgins? I look up to see the priestess Thieno glaring at me, and I hurry to catch up. Thieno's no virgin. She's fierce Antenor's wife, and a piece of tempered work to be reckoned with. I follow the women down a shadowed staircase to a broad basement, lit only with a few candles. Here Thieno looks around, moves a tapestry aside, removes an oddly shaped key from a pocket in her robe, slides it into a seemingly solid wall, and the slab of wall pivots opening onto a steeper staircase lighted with torches. Thieno hurries us all through. There is a corridor leading to four rooms in this basement under the basement, and I'm herded into the final room, a small place by temple standards, little more than 20 feet by 20 feet, furnished only by a central wooden table, four fire tripods barely glowing, one in each corner, and a single statue of Athena, cruder and smaller than all of the sculptures above. This Athena is less than 4 feet tall. "This is the real Palladian, Hockenberry," whispers Helen, referring to the sacred sculpture carved from a stone which fell from heaven one day, thus showing Athena's blessing over the city of Ilium. "When the Palladian is stolen, so the century-old story goes, Troy will fall." Thieno and Hecuba stare Helen into silence. My former lover, well, my former one-night stand, dumps the contents of her bag on the table, and we all sit on the wooden stools, staring at the Hades helmet, morphing bracelet, taser baton, and QT medallion. Only the medallion looks like it might be worth anything. The rest of the stuff I'd probably pass over at a garage sale. Hecuba speaks to Helen. "Tell this man that we must see if his story can be true, if these toys of his have any power." Hector's and Paris's mother lifts the morphing bracelet. I know she can't activate it, but I still say, "That has only minutes of power in it. Don't fool around with it." The old woman shoots me a scathing glance. Laodice picks up the taser baton and turns it in her pale hands. "This is the weapon you used to stun Patroclus?" she asks. It is the first time she's spoken in my presence, yes. "How does it work?" I tell her the three spots I have to tap and twist to activate the wand. I'm certain that the thing is designed to work only when I'm holding it. Certainly the gods wouldn't be so foolish as to leave the weapon usable for others if I lost it, even though the double tap and single twist are a safety mechanism of sorts. I start to explain to Laodice and the others that only I can use the gods' tools. Laodice aims the taser at my chest and taps the shaft of the wand again. Once when I was hiking with Susan in Brown County, Indiana, we were crossing a hilltop meadow when lightning struck just 10 paces from me, knocking me off my feet, blinding me and leaving me semi-conscious for several minutes. We used to joke about that, about the odds against it, but the memory of the jolt used to make my mouth go dry. This blast is worse. It feels as if someone has hit me in the chest with a hot poker, I fly off my stool, land numbly on the stone floor, and remember spasming like an epileptic, my arms and legs kicking wildly before I lose consciousness. When I come to, hurting, my ears buzzing, my head aching, the four women are ignoring me, looking into the corner at nothing. Four women? I thought there were five. I sit up and shake my head, trying to get my vision back in focus. Andromache's missing. Perhaps she went for help to find a healer. Maybe the women thought I was dead. Suddenly Andromache flickers into visibility in the empty space where the others are looking. Hector's wife pulls the Hades helmet cowl from her shoulders and holds it out. The helmet of death works, just as the old tales say, says Andromache. Why would the gods give it to such as he? She nods in my direction and drops the leather and metal cowl helmet onto the table. Vienna holds up the QT medallion. We can't make this work, she says. Show us. It takes me a fuzzy moment to realize that the priestess is speaking to me. Why should I? I say, getting to my feet and leaning on the table. Why should I help any of you? Helen comes around the table and puts her hand on my forearm. I pull my arm away. Hockenberry, she purrs. Don't you know that the gods have sent you to us? What are you talking about? I look around the room. No, the gods can't hear us in here, says Helen. The walls of this room are lined with lead. The gods can neither see nor hear through solid lead. This has been known for centuries. I squint around me. What the hell, why not? Superman's X-ray vision never worked through lead either. But why would there be a god-proof room in Athena's temple? Andromache steps closer. Helen's friend, Hockenberry. We, the women of Troy and Helen, have plotted for years to end this war. But the men, Achilles, the Argives, our own Trojan husbands and fathers, have power over us. They answer only to the gods. Now the gods have heard our most secret prayers and sent you as our instrument. With your help and our planning, we will change the course of events here, saving not only our city, our lives, and our children's lives, but also the destiny of mankind, freeing us from the rule of cruel and arbitrary deities. I shake my head again and actually laugh. There's a slight flaw in your logic, madam. Why would the gods send me as your instrument if your goal is to overthrow the gods? That makes no sense. The five Trojan women stare at me for a moment. Then Helen says, there are more gods than I dreamt of in your philosophy, Hockenberry. I stare at her for a second, then decide it has to be a coincidence. Either that or I'm not hearing correctly. My chest still hurts and my muscles ache from the spasms the taser caused. Give me the tools, I say, testing. The women slide to me the Hades helmet, the taser baton, the morphing bracelet, and the QT medallion. I lift the baton as if to hold them all at bay. What's your plan? I ask. My husband never would have believed me if I'd reported to him that the goddess Aphrodite had appeared and taken Scamandrius and his nurse away to be held for ransom, says Andromache. Hector has served these gods all his life. He's not the egomaniac that man-killer Achilles is. Hector would have thought that anything the gods did was only a test of him. Unless Aphrodite or another god were to kill our son in front of witnesses, in front of Hector himself, in that case his rage would know no bounds. Why didn't you kill my son? I have no words to answer that, so Andromache answers for me. You are a sentimental fool, she snaps. You say that Scamandrius will be dashed to his death on the rocks if you do not change the plans of the gods, yes. And yet you refuse to kill the child who already is fated to die, even though your entire plan to end this war and win your own battle with the gods depended upon it. You are weak, Hockenberry. Yes, I say. Hecuba beckons me to sit, but I remain standing, taser baton in hand. What's your plan to end this war, I ask. I'm almost afraid to ask. Would Andromache kill her own son to get her way? I look into her eyes, and I'm even more afraid. We will tell you our plan, says old Queen Hecuba. But first you must prove to us that these last two god toys work. She gestures to the morphing bracelet and the medallion. Watching them all carefully, I slip the bracelet on. The indicator tells me that there's less than 3 minutes of actual morph time remaining. I use its scanning functioning to look at Hecuba, then trigger the morphing function. The real Hecuba disappears as I assume her quantum probability wave space. "Believe me now?" I say in Hecuba's voice. I raise my wrist, Hecuba's wrist, and show them the morphing bracelet. I bring the taser baton out from her gown. The four remaining women, including Helen, gasp and step back, as shocked as if I'd cut the old dowager down with a short sword. More shocked, probably. Death by swords they know all too well. I drop out of morph, and Hecuba flicks back into existence on her side of the room. She blinks, although I know she's had no sense of time passing, and the five women gabble together. I check the bracelet's virtual indicator. 2:28 of morph time left. I slip the QT medallion chain around my neck. At least this device doesn't seem to have any power limits. "You want me to QT out of here and then back to show you that this also works?" I ask. Hecuba has recovered her composure. "No," she says. "All of our plans, yours and ours, will depend upon your ability to travel to Olympus undetected and to return. Can you take one of us there now?" I hesitate again. "I can," I say at last. "But the Hades helmet provides invisibility only for one. If I brought one of you to Olympus with me, you'd be seen." "Then you must bring something back here that will prove that you have traveled to Olympus," says Hecuba. I lift my hands, palms up. "What, Zeus's chamber pot?" All five women step back again, as if I've shouted some obscenity. I remember that, for very good reason, blasphemy is not the casual sport it was in my time, at the end of the 20th century. These gods are very real, and insulting them has consequences. I glance at the walls and hope the lead really shields us from Olympus's view.
"Not because of the chamber pot quip, but because we seem to be planning deicide here."
"When I was with Aphrodite during the judgment of the gods," Helen says softly, "I noticed that the goddess brushed her lustrous hair with a beautiful comb, forged in silver, shaped by some god of craft. Go to her chambers on Olympus and bring it back." I start to remind them of what I'd told them, that Aphrodite was currently floating in a healing vat, but then realized that it made no difference. Her comb wouldn't be in the vat with her. "All right," I say, grasping the medallion and lifting on the Hades helmet. "Don't wander away while I'm gone." I had the cowl in place before I triggered the medallion, so my voice must have come from emptiness in the second or two before I QT'd. I don't know for sure where Aphrodite's private chambers are. She probably has one of those white temple-sized homes along the crater lake up here. But I do remember that the time she took me aside, almost seducing me, when she told me that I had to kill Athena, the muse had brought me to Aphrodite in a chamber just off the Great Hall of the Gods. If it wasn't her private chambers, it seemed at least an apartment she kept in the Great Hall, a sort of Olympian pied-à-terre. I flick into solidity in the Great Hall and hold my breath. The many mezzanines are empty, the hall is mostly dark, and the giant holographic viewing pool shows only three-dimensional static. But several gods are here, including Zeus, whom I thought to be away, sitting on Mount Ida, watching the carnage on the Ilium battlefield. The king of gods is on his high golden throne. Nearby are several other male gods, including Apollo. They're all 10 feet tall or taller. I'm 40 feet away, and I'm invisible under the Hades helmet, but I almost QT away. I'm so afraid they'll hear me breathing. But their attention is on something else. In front of and below the throne, in the center of the gods' circle of attention, looking incongruous here, to say the least, are what looks like a giant, pitted, cracked, metallic crab shell the size of a Ford Expedition. A couple of futuristic-looking devices, and a small, shiny, vaguely humanoid robot. The robot is speaking, in English. The gods are listening, but they don't look happy. 38. Atlantis and Earth Orbit. "I don't understand why the post-humans called this place we're headed Atlantis," said Harmon.
Savi at the crawler controls said, "I can't say that I ever understood the vast majority of the post's actions."
Beeman looked up from munching slowly on his third of the only remaining food bar. "What's odd about the name Atlantis?" "On the Lost Age maps," said Harmon, The Atlantic Ocean is the big body of water west of here, beyond the hands of Hercules. We're in the basin of what used to be the Mediterranean Sea. It's not in the Atlantic. It's not? Said Demon. No. So? Said Demon. Harmon shrugged and fell quiet, but Savi said, It's possible the posts were being whimsical when they named their base here. But I seem to recall that a pre-Lost Age writer named Plato had talked about a city or kingdom called Atlantis in these regions back when there was water here. Plato, mused Harmon. I've run across references to him in books I've read, and an odd drawing I saw once, a dog. Savi nodded. A lot of the meaning of Lost Age iconography has been lost forever. What's a dog? Asked Harmon. He sipped from Savi's water bottle. The third of the food bar hadn't been enough to satisfy his hunger, but there was no more food in the crawler. A small mammal that used to be very common, kept as a pet, said Savi. I don't know why the posts allowed them to go extinct. Perhaps the Rubicon virus targeted dogs as well. Like horses? Said Demon. He thought the huge, scary animals in the Turin drama had been pure fantasy until recently. Smaller and hairier than horses, said Savi, but equally extinct. Why would the posts bring back dinosaurs? Demon asked with a real shudder. And not those wonderful Turin horses and these dog things. As I said, repeated Savi, much of the post's behavior was hard to understand. They had awakened shortly after dawn and driven north-northwest all day, rumbling down the red clay road through fields rich with every sort of crop Demon was familiar with, and many he'd never seen. Twice they'd come to shallow rivers, and once a deep, empty Perm Creek canal, all of which the crawler had crossed easily with its huge wheels and wildly articulated struts. There were servitors in the fields, and the commonplace look of them reassured Demon until he realized that many of these servitors were huge. Some 12 or 15 feet tall and half that broad, much larger than the machines he was used to. And as they drove deeper into the basin, both the crops and servitors continued to look more alien. The crawler was lumbering between tall green walls of what Savi said was sugarcane. The road, not quite wide enough for the crawler and green stalks crunching under the six wheels, when Harmon noticed the gray-green humanoid things slipping through the fields on either side. The forms moved so fluidly and quickly that they did not disturb the close-packed cane, flowing like ghost corpses passing through the tall stalks. Talibani, said Savi, I don't think they'll attack. I thought you said you fixed it so they wouldn't, said Demon. You know, that DNA stuff from the hair you stole from Harmon and me. Savi smiled. Deals with Ariel are never certain, but I suspect that if the Calibani were going to stop us, they would have done it last night. Won't the force field around the sphere hold them off? Asked Demon. The old woman shrugged. Calibani are more clever than Voynix. They might surprise us. Demon shuddered and watched the fields, catching only glimpses of the pale figures. The crawler moved out of the lane between the sugarcane fields and climbed a low hill. The road ran on through broad fields of winter wheat, stalks no taller than 15 or 16 inches, entire fields rippling in the breeze from the west. The Calibani, at least a dozen on each side of the road, came out of the cane fields behind them and loped along through the wheat, keeping a distance of 60 yards or so. Out in the open they ran on all fours. I don't like the looks of them, said Demon. You'd probably like the looks of Caliban even less, said Savi. I thought these were Calibani, said Demon. The old woman never seemed to make sense for long. Savi smiled, steering the crawler across and over a row of six pipes carrying something from west to east or east to west. It's said that the Calibani are cloned from the single Caliban, the third element of the Gaic Trinity, along with Ariel and Prospero. It's said? Mocked Demon. Everything's gossip with you. Don't you know anything from first-hand knowledge? These old stories are absurd. Some are, agreed Savi. And even though I've been alive 1,500 years or more, that doesn't mean I've been around all that time. So I have to report second-hand things I hear and read. What do you mean you haven't been around all that time? Asked Harmon. He sounded very interested. Savi laughed, but not, Demon thought, with much amusement in her voice. I'm better nano-engineered for repair than you, Eloy, she said. But nobody lives forever. Or for 1,400 years, or even 1,000. I spend most of my time like Dracula, sleeping in the long-term cryo-creches in places like the Golden Gate Bridge. I pop out from time to time, try to see what's going on, try to find a way to get my friends out of the blue beam, then back into the cold. Harmon leaned forward. How many years have you been awake? Fewer than 300, said Savi, and even that's enough to tire a body out, and a mind, and a spirit. Who's Dracula? Asked Demon. Savi, not answering, kept driving the crawler north by northwest. She told them the site they were headed for was about 300 miles from the shoreline, where they'd entered the basin from the land that had been called Israel. A word Demon had never heard. But the phrase 300 miles meant little to Harmon, and nothing at all to Demon, since trips by Voynix, Pulled Cariole, or Droshky were never longer than a mile or two. Anything farther than that, and Demon would fax. Anyone would fax. Still, they had covered half that distance by midday. But then the red clay road ended. The terrain grew rough, and the crawler had to move much more slowly, sometimes detouring for miles before returning to its course. Savi kept that course by using a small instrument from her pack and checking distances on a hand-drawn, much-folded map. Why don't you use the palm-finding function? Demon asked. Farnet and Allnet work here in the basin, said Savi, but Proxnet doesn't, and the place we're heading is in Node-Net databank. I'm using a map and an ancient thing called a compass. Works, though. How does it work? Asked Harmon. Magic, said Savi. That was answer enough for Demon. They continued to descend, the basin topography falling away above and behind them, the orderly rows of crops replaced now by boulder fields, gullies, and occasional stands of bamboo or high ferns. The Calabani were no longer visible, but it began to rain shortly after they reached the rough areas, and the creatures might have been just beyond the curtains of falling water. The crawler passed odd artifacts, the hulls of numerous ships made of wood and steel, a city of tumbled Ionian columns, ancient plastic objects gleaming in gray sediment, the bleached bones of numerous sea creatures, and several huge, rusted tanks that Savi called submarines. In the afternoon, the rain lifted some, and the three saw a high mesa appear to the northeast. It was high and broad and rolling rather than peaked, more mountain than mesa, green on top, ridged on the sides with steep, rilled cliffs. Is that where we're going? Asked Demon. No, said Savi. That's Cyprus. I lost my virginity there 1,482 years ago next Tuesday. Demon exchanged covert glances with Harmon. Both men had the good sense not to say anything. By late afternoon, the terrain became lower and marshier, and fields of crops began appearing on either side of a rough, red clay road again. Oddly formed servitors were working the fields, but none looked up to watch the crawler trundle past. Most of the machines didn't appear to have eyes. Once their way was blocked by a river at least 200 yards across, Savi sealed the slice door, shutting off the fresh air they'd been enjoying, made sure the sphere force field was activated, and rolled the crawler down the bank. The water was deep, 40 feet or more near the center of the channel, and even the crawler's searchlights had trouble cutting through the silt and gloom. The current was stronger than Demon would have imagined for such a wide, deep river, and the crawler was buffeted around violently enough that Savi had to work the virtual controls and fight the machine back onto the proper course. Demon guessed that a machine with smaller wheels, less flexible struts, or less motor power would have been carried away to the west. When they emerged on the north shore, the machine throwing mud 30 feet behind them and water rushing off the spider struts like a waterfall, Harmon said. I didn't know the crawler could be driven underwater. Neither did I, said Savi. She took a bearing north by northwest and drove on. The first energy constructs appeared shortly after that, and Harmon was the first to notice them. The first device was shimmering and shifting 30 yards to the left of the clay road in an opening beyond a stand of bamboo. Savi stopped so they could get out and see, although Demon was leery of getting away from the crawler, even though they'd seen no Kalabani for several hours. But Harmon wanted to see it, and Demon didn't want to stay in the sphere alone, so he ended up following the two down the strut ladder and across the field toward the glowing object. It felt strange to Demon to be walking again after so many hours sitting. The first energy construct was small, about 20 feet long by 8 or 10 high. Yellow and orange with moving green veins, roughly spherical with pseudopods growing out of the top, bottom, and ends, the forms blobbing into shapes of their own and then being reabsorbed by the central mass. The thing floated about 4 feet off the ground, and Demon would get no closer than 20 paces, even as Savi and Harmon walked right up to it. "What is it?" asked Harmon, his head and shoulders disappearing for a minute behind the slowly flowing thing. "We're in the suburbs of Atlantis," said Savi, "even though we're still 60 miles or so away. The posts built their ground stations out of this material." "What material?" said Harmon. He stretched his hand toward the yellow ovoid. "Can I touch it?" "Some of the shapes shock, some don't. None kill. Go ahead and try it. It won't melt your hand." Harmon set his fingers against the curve of the shiny shape. His hand disappeared inside. When he quickly pulled it out, molten blobs of yellow and orange dripped off his fingers and then flew back to the shape. "Cold," he said. "Very cold." He flexed his fingers and winced. "It's essentially one large molecule," said Savi, "although how that's possible, I don't know." "What's a molecule?" called Demon. He'd taken a few steps backward when Harmon's hand disappeared and had to raise his voice to be heard now. He also kept checking over his shoulder. Savi had the gun in her belt, but the bamboo forest was too close for Demon's comfort. It was almost dark. "Molecules are the little things that everything else is made of," said Savi. "You can't see them without special lenses." "I can see that one easily enough," said Demon. Sometimes he thought talking to Savi was like talking to a young child, although Demon had never spent time around a young child. The three walked back to the crawler. Rich evening sunlight prismed off the passenger sphere and made the high, articulated struts glow. The tops of stratocumulus far to their east, toward the hill called Cyprus, caught the golden light. "Atlantis is made up mostly of this macromolecular frozen energy," said the old woman. "It's part of the quantum screwing around that the posts were always up to. There is real material mixed in, something the Lost Age scientists called exotic matter, but I don't know the ratio or how it works. I just know that it makes their cities, stations, whatever they are, sort of shapeshifters, phasing in and out of our quantum reality." "I don't understand," said Harmon, freeing Demon of the necessity of saying it. "You'll see for yourself soon enough. We should be able to see the city when we get over that large rise on the horizon and be there about the time it gets dark." They climbed into the crawler and took their seats, but before Savi could shift the big machine into gear, Harmon said, "You've been here before." He didn't pose it as a question. "Yes." "But you said before that you've never been to the orbital rings. Was that your reason for coming before?" "Yes," said Savi. "I still think the answer to freeing my friends from the neutrino beam lies up there." She flicked her head toward the E and P rings, bright in the twilight sky above. "But you didn't succeed before," said Harmon. "Why?" Savi swiveled in her chair and looked at him. "I'll tell you why and how I failed if you'll tell me why you really want to go up there. Why you've spent years trying to find a way up to the rings." Harmon returned her gaze for a minute and then looked away. "I'm curious," he said. "No," said Savi. She waited. He looked back at her, and Demon realized that the older man's face showed the most emotion Demon had seen from him. "You're right," snapped Harmon. "It's not some sort of idle curiosity. I want to find the fermery." "So you can live longer," Savi said softly. Harmon balled his fists. "Yes, so I can live longer, so I can continue to exist beyond this fucking final 20. Because I'm greedy for life. Because I want Ada to have my child, and I want to be around to see it grow up, even though fathers don't do things like that. because I'm a greedy bastard, greedy for life. Are you satisfied? Yes, said Savi. She looked at Demon. And what are your reasons for coming on this trip, Demon Ur? Demon shrugged. I'd jump home in a second if there was a fax portal nearby. There isn't, said Savi. Sorry. He ignored the sarcasm and said, Why did you bring us, old woman? You know the way here. You know how to find the crawler. Why bring us? Fair question, she said. The last time I came to Atlantis, I came on foot. From the north. It was a century and a half ago, and I brought two Eloi with me. I'm sorry, that's an insulting term. I brought two young women with me. They were curious. What happened, said Harmon. They died. How? Asked Demon. The Calibani? No, the Calibani killed and ate the man and woman who came with me the time before that, almost 3 centuries ago. I didn't know how to contact the aerial biosphere then, nor about the DNA. Why do you always come in threes? Asked Harmon. Demon thought it an odd question. He was ready to ask for more details about all these dead traveling companions. Did she mean permanently dead or just firmary repair dead? Savi laughed. You ask good questions, Harmon Ur. You'll see soon. You'll see why I've come with two others after that first solo visit of mine to Atlantis more than a millennium ago. And not just to Atlantis, but to some of their other stations. In the Himalayas, Easter Island, one actually at the South Pole. Those were fun trips, since a Sony can't get within 300 miles of any of them. She'd lost Demon. He wanted to hear more about the killing and eating. But you've never found a spaceship, a shuttle, to get you up there, said Harmon, after all these tries? There are no spaceships, said Savi. She activated the virtual controls, slammed the crawler in gear, and guided them north by northwest as the sunset spilled red across the entire western sky. The city of the post-humans spread for miles across the dry seabed, with glowing energy towers rising and falling 1,000 feet high. The crawler trundled between energy obelisks, floating spheres, red energy stairways going nowhere, blue ramps that appeared and disappeared, blue pyramids folding into themselves, a giant green torus that moved back and forth along pulsing yellow rods, and countless colored cubes and cones. When Savi stopped and slid the door slice open, even Harmon seemed hesitant to get out. Savi had made sure they were wearing their thermskins, and now she pulled 3 osmosis masks from the crawler's tool locker. It was almost dark now, the stars joining the rotating rings in the purple-black sky above them. The glow from the energy city illuminated seabed and farm fields for 5 miles in each direction. Savi led them to a red stairway and then up, the macromolecular steps holding their weight, although Demon thought it felt like walking on giant sponges. 100 feet above the seabed floor, the staircase ended at a black platform made out of a dull, dark metal that reflected no light. In the center of the square platform were 3 ancient-looking wooden chairs with high backs and red seat cushions. The chairs were equidistantly spaced around a black hole in the black platform, about 10 feet apart, facing outward. Sit, said Savi. Is this a joke, said Demon? Savi shook her head and sat in the chair facing west. Harmon took his seat. Demon walked around the black platform again, returned to the single empty chair. What happens next, he asked. We have to wait here for something? He looked at the tall yellow tower thrusting up hundreds of feet nearby, the energy material rearranging itself like a rectangular yellow cloud. Sit and you'll find out, said Savi. Demon took his seat gingerly. The back of the chair and the thick arms were elaborately carved. There was a white circle on the left arm of the chair and a red circle on the right arm. He touched neither. When I count to 3, said Savi, depress the white button. That's the one on your left if you're colorblind, Demon. I'm not colorblind, goddammit. All right, said the old woman. 1... 2. Wait, wait, said Demon. What's going to happen to me if I press the white circle? Absolutely nothing, said Savi. But we have to press it at the same time. I learned this when I came here alone. Ready? 1. 2. 3. They all pressed their white circles. Demon leaped out of his chair and ran to the edge of the black platform, and then the red platform 30 paces beyond that before turning to look back. The blast of energy behind his chair had been deafening. "Holy crap!" he shouted, but the two still in their chairs could not hear him. It was like lightning, he thought, a searing blast of jagged energy just a yard or so across, emanating from the black hole in the middle of the chair triangle and rising up into the dark sky, rising higher, higher, then curving to the west like some impossible white-hot thread arching west until the end of it disappeared from sight above.
But the thread, visible and also moving, as if the lightning were connected to... It was connected, Demon realized with a flood of fear that almost made him void his bowels.
Connected to the moving E-ring thousands of miles above. Connected to one of the stars, one of the moving lights now crossing from west to east in that ring. "Come back!" Savi was shouting above the crackle and roar of the lightning thread. It took Demon several minutes to come back, to walk to that empty wooden chair shielding his eyes, his shadow and the chair's shadow thrown out 50 feet across the black and red rooftop by the blinding, crackling light. He could never explain later, even to himself, how or why he returned to that chair, or why he did what he did next. "On the count of three, depress the red circle," shouted Savi. The old woman's gray hair was standing on end, whipping around her head like short snakes. She had to scream above the energy roar to be heard. "One! Two! I absolutely can't do this," was Demon's litany to himself. "I absolutely won't do this." "Three!" shouted Savi. She pressed her red circle. Harmon pressed his red circle. "No!" fought Demon, but pressed down hard on his red circle. The three wooden chairs shot skyward, rotating around the crackling, shifting cord of lightning, shooting upward so quickly that a sonic boom echoed across the seabed floor, shaking the crawler on its springs. A second later, less than a second later, the three chairs were out of sight overhead as the thread of pure white energy twisted and writhed and arched to follow the hurtling points of light on the equatorial orbital ring. 39. Olympus, Ilium, and Olympus. "The little robot fascinates me, and I'm tempted to stay in the great hall of the gods and find out what's going on, but I'm leery of getting closer, because the gods might hear me in this vast, hushed space." The dialogue between the gods and the robot has shifted to ancient Greek now. At least the gods, including Zeus, are speaking in the common language I've grown used to here. But I'm far enough away that I can catch only fragments of it. "Little automatons, toys from the great inland sea should be destroyed. Rather than try to creep closer, I remember why I'm here, Aphrodite's come, and the importance of my getting back to the Trojan women. The fate of hundreds of thousands of people below may depend on what I do next. So I tiptoe backward away from the gods and the odd machines, and find my way down the long side corridor to the little suite of rooms where I first met the goddess of love just a few days ago." Can it just be a few days ago? Much has happened since then, to say the least. There are voices, gods' voices, echoing from elsewhere in the great hall, and I slip into Aphrodite's pied-à-terre with my pulse pounding in my throat. The place is, as I remember it from a few days ago, windowless, lighted by only a few tripod braziers, with only the couch and a few other pieces of furniture, including a softly glowing blue screen on the marble desk. I'd thought at the time that the screen was like a computer screen, and I crossed to it now to look. It's true. The glowing blue rectangle is separate from the desktop, hovering an inch or two above the marble surface, and while there's no Microsoft Windows menu on it, a single white circle floats there as if inviting me to touch it and activate the screen. I leave it alone. Near the couch is where I remember some of Aphrodite's personal items on a small round table, although I'm only hoping that there's a comb among them. There's not. I see a silver brooch and some silver cylinders, divine lipsticks, and an elaborately carved silver mirror lying face down, but no comb. Damn it. I have no idea where Aphrodite's home is among the estates scattered around on the broad green summit of Olympus, and I certainly can't ask one of the gods for directions. I'd gambled and lost on Helen's challenge to bring back the comb, but the important thing was to show them that I have the ability to travel to Olympus and back, and speed is of the essence. I have no idea how long the Trojan women will wait. I grabbed the mirror without looking at it carefully, envision the basement room in Ilium's Temple of Athena, and twist the QT medallion. There are 7 women there when I flick into existence, not the 5 women I'd left in the basement room a few minutes before. All of the women take a step back when I arrive, but one of them shrieks wildly and throws her hands over her face. I still have time to see that face, and I recognize it. This is Cassandra, King Priam's loveliest daughter. "Did you bring us the Kalmhakenberry as proof of your ability to travel to and from Olympus, as do the gods?" asks Hecuba. "I didn't have time to search for it," I say. "I brought this instead." I hand the mirror to the nearest woman, Laodice, Hecuba's daughter. Helen says, "The carving on the silver handle in the back of the mirror is similar to what I remember of the goddess's comb, but..." She stops speaking as Laodice gasps and almost drops the mirror. The mirror is picked up by the priestess, Theano, who looks into it, goes white, and hands it to Andromache. Hector's wife looks into it and blushes. Cassandra grabs it from Andromache, lifts it, stares into it, and screams again. Hecuba grabs the mirror away and frowns at Cassandra. I can tell immediately that there is no love lost between these two women, and I remember why. Cassandra, given the power of prophecy by Apollo, had urged King Priam to have Hecuba's baby, Paris, killed upon birth. From her childhood onward, Cassandra has foreseen the disaster resulting from Helen's capture and the ensuing war. But according to tradition, Apollo's gift of prophecy to the girl was accompanied by the curse that no one would ever believe her. Now Hecuba is staring into the mirror, mouth slack. "What is it?" I ask. "There must be something wrong with the mirror." Helen takes the mirror from Hector's mother and hands it to me. "Do you see, Huckenberry?" I look into the glass. My reflection is odd. I'm me there, but also not me. My chin is stronger, my nose smaller, my eyes bolder, my cheekbones higher, my teeth whiter. "Is this what you've all seen?" I ask. "This idealized reflection of yourself?" "Yes," says Helen. "Aphrodite's looking glass shows only beauty. We have looked upon ourselves as goddesses," which she already is, but I nod and touch the surface of the mirror. It's not glass, it feels soft, resilient, rather like an LCD screen on a laptop computer. Perhaps that's what it is, and inside the carved backing might be powerful microchips and video morphing programs running algorithms of symmetry, idealized proportions, and other elements of perceived human beauty. "Huckenberry," says Helen, "let me introduce 2 others we've brought here this morning to judge whether you speak the truth. This younger woman is Cassandra, daughter of Priam. This older woman is Herophile, beloved of Hera, the oldest of the Sibyls and priestess of Apollo Smithnius. It was Herophile who interpreted Hecuba's dream, lo, those many years ago." "What dream is that?" I ask. Hecuba, who, it appears, will not look at Herophile or Cassandra, says, "When I was pregnant with my 2nd child, Paris, I dreamed that I gave birth to a burning brand that spread its fire to all of Ilium, burning it to the ground. And that child became a rampaging Erinyes, a child of Cronos, some say, the daughter of Phorcus, say others, and the offspring of Hades and Persephone, say still others. But, all acknowledge, most likely the daughter of deadly night. This Erinyes of flame had no wings, but it resembled the harpies. The smell of its breath was sulphurous. A poisonous slaver poured from its eyes. Its voice was like the lowing of terrified cattle. It bore in its belt a whip of brass-studded thongs. It carried a torch in one hand and a serpent in the other, and its home was in the underworld. And it was born to avenge all and any slights against mothers. Its approach was heralded by all the dogs of Ilium barking as if in pain." "Wow," I say, "that's quite a dream." "I perceived the Erinyes to be the child later named Paris," says the old hag named Herophile. "Cassandra also saw this and recommended that the baby boy be killed the moment he emerged from the womb. The old priestess gave Hecuba a scolding look. Our advice was ignored. Helen literally steps between the women. Everyone here, Hockenberry, has had visions of Troy being put to the torch. But we do not know which of our visions arise merely from anxiety for ourselves, our children, and our husbands, and which visions are gifts of true sight from the gods. So must we judge yours. Cassandra has questions for you. I turn to look at the younger woman. She is blonde and anorectic, but somehow still stunningly beautiful. Cassandra's fingernails are bitten short and bloody, and her fingers are always twitching and intertwining. She can't stand still. Her eyes are as red-rimmed as her nails. Looking at her reminds me of photos I've seen of gorgeous movie starlets in rehab for coke addiction. "I have not dreamt of you, weak-looking man," she says. I ignore the insult and say nothing. "But I ask you this," she continues. "I once dreamt of King Agamemnon and his queen Clytemnestra as a great royal bull and cow. What does this dream say to you, O prophet?" "I'm no prophet," I say. "Your future is merely my past. But you see Agamemnon as a bull because he will be slaughtered like an ox upon his arrival home to Sparta." "In his own palace?" "No," I say. I feel like I'm in the crucible of oral exams at Hamilton College, my undergraduate alma mater. "Agamemnon will be killed in the house of Aegisthus." "By whose hand, at whose will?" presses Cassandra. "Clytemnestra's." "For what reason, O non-prophet?" "Her anger at Agamemnon's sacrifice of their daughter Iphigenia." Cassandra continues to stare at me, but she nods slightly to the other women. "And what do you dream of me in my future, O seer?" she asks sarcastically. "You will be savagely raped in this very temple," I say. None of the women appears to be breathing. I wonder if I've gone too far. Well, this witch wants the truth. I'll give her the truth. Cassandra seems unfazed, even pleased. I realize that the young prophetess has been seeing this rape for most of her life. No one has listened to her warnings. It must be refreshing for her to hear someone else confirm her vision. But her voice sounds anything but pleased when she speaks again. "Who will rape me in this temple?" "Ajax." "Little Ajax or big Ajax?" asks the woman. Cassandra looks neurotic and anxious, but also very lovely in a vulnerable way. "Little Ajax," I say. "Ajax of Locris." "And what will I be doing upstairs in this temple, little man, when big Ajax of Locris ravages me?" "Trying to save or hide the Pleiadion," I answer. I nod toward the small statue just 10 feet from me. "And does little Ajax go unpunished, O man?" "He'll drown on his way home," I say, "when his ship is wrecked on the Gyrian rocks." Most scholars think this is a sign of Athena's wrath. "Will she bring doom to Ajax of Locris out of anger at my rape, or to avenge the desecration of her temple?" demands Cassandra. "I don't know, probably the latter." "Who else will be in the temple upstairs when I am raped, O man?" I have to think a second here. "Odysseus," I say at last, my voice rising at the end like a student's hoping his answer is correct. "Who else besides Odysseus, the son of Laertes, will be witness to my defilement that night?" "Neoptolemus," I say at last. "Achilles' son?" interrupts Theano with a sneer. "He's 9 years old back in Argos." "No," I say. "He's 17 years old and a fierce warrior. They will call him here from Scyros after Achilles is killed, and Neoptolemus will be with Odysseus in the belly of the great wooden horse." "Wooden horse?" says Andromache. But I can see from the dilated pupils in Helen, Herophile, and Cassandra that these women have had visions of the horse. "Does this Neoptolemus have another name?" asks Cassandra. She has the tone and intensity of a dedicated public prosecutor. "He will be known to future generations as Pyrrhus," I say. I'm trying to remember minutiae from the B.D. Scholia, from the Cyclic Poets, from Proclus Cypria, and from my Pindar. It's been a long time since I read Pindar. "Neoptolemus will not sail back to Achilles' old home on Scyros after the war," I say, "but will land in Molossia on the western side of the island, where later kings will call him Piras and say they are descended from him. Will he commit any other acts on the night the Greeks take Troy? Presses Cassandra.
I look at my jury of Trojan women. Priam's wife, Priam's daughter, Scamandria's mother, Athena's priestess, a sibyl with paranormal powers. Then this vision accursed, child woman and Helen, wife of both Menelaus and Paris. On the whole, I would prefer OJ's jurors. Pyrrhus, known now as Neoptolemus, will slaughter King Priam that night in Zeus's temple, I say. He will throw Scamandrius down from the walls and dash the baby's brains out on the rocks. He will personally drive Andromache to the slave ship. This I have told the others already. And will this night come soon? Presses Cassandra. Yes. In months and years or days and weeks? Days and weeks, I say. I try to estimate how many days it will be before Achilles will kill Hector and Troy will fall, if and when the Iliad timetable reasserts itself. Not many. Now tell me, O man, what my fate will be after the rape of Ilium and Cassandra, snaps Cassandra. Here I hesitate. My mouth goes dry. Your fate, I manage. My fate, O man of the future, hisses the beautiful blonde. Surely, ravaged or not, I'll not be left behind when Andromache is dragged off to slavery, and noble Helen is claimed again by angry Menelaus. What is to become of Cassandra, O man? I try to lick my lips. Can she see her own fate? I have no idea if Apollo's gift of prophecy goes beyond the fall of Troy. Someone, I think it was the poet-scholar Robert Graves, translated Cassandra's name as She Who Entangles Men. But she's also someone who has been cursed by the gods always to tell the truth. I decide to do the same. Your beauty will result in Agamemnon claiming you as his concubine, I say, my voice barely audible. He'll take you home with him as his concubine. Will I bear him children before we arrive? I think so, I say, sounding preposterous even to myself. I keep getting my Homer mixed up with my Virgil mixed up with my Aeschylus, and all of the above mixed up with Euripides. Hell, even Shakespeare took a whack at this story. Twin sons, I say after a pause. Telemachus and Pelops. And when I arrive at Sparta, Agamemnon's home, prompts Cassandra. Clytemnestra will kill you with the same axe she murders Agamemnon with, I say, my voice more shrill than I meant it to be. Cassandra smiles. It is not a pleasant smile. Before or after she beheads Agamemnon? After, I say. Fuck it, if she can take it, I can. I'm probably dead anyway, but I'll use the taser on as many of these bitches as I can before they drag me down. Clytemnestra has to chase you for a while, I say, but she catches you. She cuts your head off as well, and then she kills your babies. The seven women look at me for a long, silent moment, and their gazes are unreadable. I tell myself never to play poker with any of these dames. Then Cassandra says, yes, this man knows the future. Whether his vision and presence here are a gift to us from the gods or a trick of the gods to uncover our treachery, I do not know. But we must trust him with our secret. The time before the end of Ilium is too short to do otherwise. Helen nods. Hearken, Barry, use your medallion to go to the camps of the Achaeans. Bring Achilles back to the foyer of the nursery in Hector's house at the time of the next changing of the Ilium guards. I think the guards on the wall change and the gongs ring at what would be 11:30 a.m. That's about an hour from now. What if Achilles doesn't want to come with me? I ask. The collective gaze the women pour on me now is four parts contempt combined with three parts pity. I QT the hell out of there. I shouldn't do it. It's foolish, and it's mostly because I'm afraid to face Achilles. But all through Cassandra's oral quiz, I'd found myself curious about the little robot back on Olympus. I'd seen odd things on Olympus before, of course, not counting the gods and goddesses, who are weird enough. Odd things such as the giant insectoid healer. But something about the little robot, if that's what it is, had struck me. It didn't seem part of either of the worlds I've been dividing my time between over the past 9 years, neither of Olympus nor of Ilium. The little robot seemed more of my world, my old world, the real world. Don't ask me why. I've never seen a humanoid robot except in sci-fi movies. Besides, I tell myself, I have an hour before having to present Achilles to Hector. I tug on the Hades helmet and quantum teleport back to the great hall of the gods. The little robot and the other devices, including the big crab thing, are gone. But Zeus is still here. And so are more of the gods, including the war god Ares, who was last seen healing in the tank next to Aphrodite. Mother of mercy, where is Aphrodite now? She can see me even when I'm wearing this helmet. She ordered the muse to give the helmet to me only because she could track me down any time she wants. Is she out of the tank already? Jesus Christ. Ares is roaring at all the gods while Zeus sits on his throne. Madness rules below, cries the god of war. I'm gone for a few days and you let the war get out of hand. Chaos rules. Achilles has killed Agamemnon and taken command of the Achaean armies. Hector is in retreat when victory for the Trojans was royal Zeus's command. Agamemnon dead? Achilles in command? Holy shit. We're not in the Iliad anymore, Toto. And what of the automata I brought to you, Lord Zeus, these Moraveks? Demands Apollo, his voice echoing in the huge hall. I see more gods and goddesses filling the mezzanines above. The swimming pool viewing screen cut into the floor is showing scenes of madness and murder on the Trojan battle lines and in the Argive camp now. But my focus is on the huge, powerfully built, white-bearded Zeus where he sits on his golden throne. His wrists are massive, like something sculpted out of Carrara marble by Rodin. I'm close enough to see the gray hairs on Zeus's bare chest.
Calm down, Apollo, noble archer, rumbles the god of all gods. I've ordered the Moravec automata eliminated. Hera has destroyed them both by now.
Can this get worse, I wonder? Right then, Aphrodite enters the hall between Achilles' mother, Thetis, and my muse. 40. Equatorial Ring. Demons screamed all the way up. Savi and Harmon could have been screaming as well, should have been screaming, but Demon could hear only his own screams. As soon as their chairs took off vertically and then began to pitch over as they rotated around their axis of lightning, Demon faced down 10,000 feet above the green Mediterranean basin and screaming all the way. Two great restrictions began to push in on him. One, the pressure of acceleration, but the other, a constant, all over pressing in that had to be some kind of a force field. It not only held him tight on the red cushions of his hurtling chair, but it pressed against his face, chest, into his mouth, into his lungs. Demon still screamed. The three chairs continued to rotate counterclockwise around the thick bolt of white energy, and suddenly Demon was facing up at the stars and rings. He continued to scream, knowing that the chair would continue rotating, that this time he would fall out, and that now the fall would be from tens of thousands of feet higher. He didn't fall, but he screamed down at the earth as they flew higher. Their trajectory seemed almost flat now, almost parallel to the surface of the planet so far below. It was night over Central Asia, but a towering cumulus stretching hundreds of miles was lighted from within, quick flickers of lightning illuminating the red landmass glimpsed between the pearly cloud cover. Demon didn't know it was Central Asia. The chairs rotated around again, showing him the stars and rings and a quite visible thin layer of atmosphere below them now. And the sun seemed to rise again in the west, prisming across that meniscus of atmosphere in bright red and yellow streamers. They were out of 99% of the atmosphere now, but Demon didn't know that. The force field fed him air, kept him from being torn apart by G-forces, and allowed a pocket of air into which he could scream. He was getting hoarse by the time he realized that they were approaching the E-ring. The ring wasn't what he'd always imagined, but he was too busy clutching the arms of his chair and screaming to notice this. Demon had always visualized the post's E and P rings as being made up of thousands of glowing glass castles through which one could see the post-humans partying and doing whatever post-humans do. It wasn't that way at all. Most of the glowing objects they were rising towards so quickly, the wiggling, writhing thread of lightning still pitching up and away from them as they rode it higher, were complex structures of struts and cables and long glass tubes, more like antennae than orbital houses. At the end of some of these structures were glowing globes of energy, each with pulsing black spheres at their center. Other structures supported giant mirrors, each stretching miles across, Demon realized through his screaming, which were reflecting or beaming blue or yellow or dull white shafts of energy to still other mirrors. Gleaming rings and spheres looking to be made of the same energy matter and exotic materials as Atlantis, fired lasers and pulsed attitude thrusters in studied bursts that opened and spread in glowing cones of particles. None of the spheres or rings or structures looked like they could be homes for post-humans. The Earth's horizon became noticeably curved, then curved further, like a bow being slowly bent. The sun set again in the west and the sky exploded with stars, only slightly less bright than the glowing ring structures above. Far below Demon, hundreds of miles at least, he could see a range of snow-topped mountains glowing in the starlight and ring light. Farther to the west, near the sharp curved limb of the world, an ocean gleamed. Suddenly the rotation of the chair slowed and Demon craned his neck and looked up. Set amidst the moving gantry structures and mirrors moved a mountain with a glowing city wrapped around it. Forward more wildly, and the force field pressed him down into the cushions and straight back chair more fiercely. And in that second of pause, he noticed that the torquing shaft of energy along which they were sliding ended in that glowing city on the giant slab of rock. This city was not made of energy stuff. It seemed to be made of glass, and each of the 100,000 glass panes and facets was illuminated from within. It looked like a giant Japanese lantern to Demon, just as he realized that their twisting triangle of chairs was going to crash into one of the tallest circular spires on the near end of that orbiting mountain. His chair pitched completely over, and the force field squeezed the breath out of him as they decelerated hard enough to make his vision go from red to black and back to red again. They hadn't slowed enough. Demon screamed a final time, his voice completely hoarse now, and then they slammed into the building that must have been 100 stories tall. There was no crash of breaking glass, no fatal sudden stop. The building wall warped and absorbed them and funneled them down a long glowing cone, as if they'd dived into yielding yellow rubber, and then the funnel spat them out into a room with 6 glowing white walls. The shaft of energy disappeared. The chairs flew different directions. The force fields went off. Demon shouted a final time, slid across a hard floor, bounced off an even harder wall, then ricocheted to the ceiling and back to the floor. Then he saw only blackness. He was falling. Demon jerked to consciousness as his body and brain told him he was tumbling, falling. From the chair? To the earth? He opened his mouth to scream again, but closed it as he realized that he was floating in midair, with Savi holding one of his arms and Harmon the other. Floating? Falling. He writhed and wriggled, but Savi and Harmon, who were also floating in the white room, tumbled in the air with him, still holding him by the arms. "It's all right," said Savi. "We're in zero G." "In what?" gasped Demon. "Zero gravity. No, wait. Here, put this on." She handed him one of the crawler's osmosis masks. Someone had already pulled his thermskin cowl over his face, and the smart suit had extended its gloves over his hands. Now Demon struggled in confusion, but the old woman and the older man tugged the clear osmosis mask into place over his nose and mouth. "It's meant as an emergency rebreather in case of fire or toxic gases," said Savi, "but it'll work in vacuum for a few hours." "Vacuum?" repeated Demon. "The post city has lost gravity and a lot of its air," said Harmon. "We've already been through the wall while you were unconscious. There's enough air to swim through, but not quite thick enough to breathe." "Enough air to swim through? Already been through the wall?" thought Demon through his headache. "They're both crazy now." "How do you lose gravity?" he said aloud. I think they used force fields to give them some gravity on this asteroid, said Savi. This rock isn't big enough to generate much of its own, and the city inside shows some signs of being oriented toward the ground. Neiman didn't ask what an asteroid was. He didn't particularly care. Can we get back down, he said, but immediately added, I'm not sitting on one of those chairs again. Savi's smile was visible through her osmosis mask. She'd taken off her outer clothing to let her therm skin work more efficiently. She was wearing a peach color, and the suit, no thicker than a coat of paint, showed how scrawny and bony the old woman really was. Armin was also wearing only his blue therm skin. Demon looked down and realized they'd stripped him of his real clothes, so that his green therm skin showed how pudgy he was. With the therm skin and osmosis mask in place, Demon heard the others' voices through his cowl ear patches, and heard the slight echo of his own voice rasping in the built-in microphones. Those chairs aren't going anywhere for a while, said Savi. She nodded toward where bits of the broken chairs and the red cushions floated. I can't believe that the posts traveled regularly to the rings on those things, said Harmon. A slight quaver in the older man's voice let Demon know that he wasn't the only one who had hated that ride. Maybe they were all roller coaster fans, said Savi. What's up? Began Demon. Never mind, said the old woman. She lifted the backpack she'd had on her lap during the whole ride up and said, Ready to go through the wall and meet the posts? Going through the wall wasn't hard at all. Passing through it felt to Demon like pushing through some sort of yielding membrane, or perhaps like swimming through a warm waterfall. Swimming. In air. Even after 30 minutes of doing it, it felt passing strange to Demon. At first he flailed around with both arms and legs kicking almost at random, the antics moving him hardly at all and invariably sending him tumbling head over heels. But then he learned the trick of kicking off from one solid object to the next, even for distances of 100 feet or more, using his legs to propel him and his cupped palms to make slight mid-course corrections. All of the buildings seemed connected through their interiors, and what looked like bright internal lighting as they'd approached turned out to be an illusion. The windows glowed warmly, but it was the windows that were emitting the light. The vast interiors, the first space they entered after emerging from the white wall, was 300 or 400 feet across and at least 1,000 feet high, with open terraces rising on 3 sides of the columnar space. Were all dimly lighted by the orange glow from the distant wall windows, giving Demon a sense of moving deep underwater. To add to that illusion of being underwater, various untended plants had grown 40 and 50 feet high and were swaying to the slight breezes like tall stands of kelp. Demon could feel the thinness of the atmosphere as he tried to swim through what was left of the air. And while the therm skin covered all exposed skin and conserved all of his body heat, he could still sense the freezing cold beyond the molecular layer. He could see its effects as well, since the inner panels of glass were covered by a thin film of ice and occasional clusters of free-floating ice crystals caught the light like dust in shafts of cathedral light. End of side 13.